This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Lots happening from Beacon Hill to Capitol Hill today. COVID cases on the rise in Massachusetts. President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure bill is caught up in a political minefield. So we are checking in with a member of our delegation about how Congress and our elected officials there should respond to both and some other things. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District, joins us from Washington, D.C. He is in the House cloakroom now. Representative Auchincloss, thanks for stepping aside and talking to us here on Radio Boston.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
So I had a full agenda, but news is going to news. So I'm going to add a new one right to the top, which is this afternoon, a lot of controversy over the fact that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has essentially pulled two of Kevin McCarthy's picks for the January 6th investigative committee, and that the Kevin McCarthy is angry. This looks like it's going to cause another blow up. What are you hearing and what are your reactions?
The purpose of this select committee is to provide an objective accounting for the American public today and for posterity about what happened on January 6th and how we prevent it from happening again. It's a matter of democratic integrity. The speaker reached out her hand to Republicans and said, let's make this bipartisan, just like we did after 9/11, for the good of the country. And the Republicans chose Trump over truth. And now they're having a tantrum because the speaker is insisting that this actually be an objective committee. They're trying to tank it, and she's trying to make sure that it actually serves its intended purpose. So I have no sympathy for what we're hearing from Leader McCarthy.
What's the path forward now?
The path forward is that the speaker is going to put people on the committee that she has confidence in and the American people can have confidence in, are truly coming to this in a spirit of curiosity, trying to seek the facts and trying to put together an objective reckoning for the public and for posterity that can really help heal our democracy. That's what the American people deserve right now. We saw a traumatizing attack on our very core institutions, and people want to see, how can we prevent this from happening again? And what are the root causes that led to this? She is going to deliver that through the select committee. And we're just not going to allow Trump through his cronies in Congress to undermine it.
So, you know, we talked to you shortly after January 6th. You are a former Marine. This has got to be personal for everyone. Talk us through how this turns out to be an objective investigation and how everybody keeps eyes clear and clean as this plays out.
I think it's personal for every American, not just for members of Congress who were in the chamber that day. And that level of emotional resonance to me is not a bad thing. It does not mean that we cannot be objective. It simply means that the urgency of getting the truth is increased, that we feel a deep obligation to have a true reckoning about what happened that day. So I don't think a high emotional register detracts from quality investigation. I mean, certainly after 9/11, Americans across the political spectrum felt incredibly invested in what had happened, but we were still able to deliver what has become, I think, a almost universally renowned report on that event. And we can do the same thing after January 6th.
All right. I want to move on to the pandemic here. Cases are on the rise, including breakthrough cases in fully vaccinated people. According to the state's Department of Public Health, as of July 17th, more than 5,000 breakthrough cases, with 80 of them being fatal. I do also want to note that fatalities in that group make up 0.0018% of the vaccinated population here, but each loss is tragic and people are spooked by this climbing cases. Are you concerned right now with the trend we're seeing?
Yes, because scientists and public health experts have been clear that we should be concerned, and the data is supporting that. Now, I'm glad that you made that point about breakthrough COVID, because although it is absolutely a reality, we should also note that it does not mean that people should not get the vaccine because they're worried that, oh, well, you still get COVID. No, the vaccine absolutely is an incredibly effective means to not get COVID. And also it means that if you do get COVID, you are drastically less likely to be hospitalized or and certainly to die from it. So definitely still get the vaccine. But I'm feeling very frustrated, to be to be candid with you, because the vaccines are in abundance now in this country. And at a time when other countries throughout the world are struggling to get enough supply, and I'll talk about that later, we're having to give pickup trucks to people to convince them to get a shot that is truly a miracle of science. So I just want to say again, get the vaccine. Do it for your own safety. Do it for the ones that you love. Because if not, not only are you putting yourself and others that you love in jeopardy, we're at risk of backsliding after so much loss and so much work.
So the pickup truck reference, of course, being the various kinds of prizes and lotteries around the country that are being offered to try to encourage people. I want to stay on this for a second. More than 4.3 million people fully vaccinated in the Commonwealth. That's about 61%. But portions of the states are holdouts. In your district, as of July 15th, 47% of residents in Fall River, in Taunton, 51%, Attleboro, 54%. I've heard just now your message to them. What are you hearing from constituents who do not or are not getting vaccinated?
So I'm proud to say that Fall River now, based on my last conversation with the mayor a few days ago, has tipped above 50% vaccination rate, and that he is doing a tremendous amount of work to continue to raise that up. There's now increasingly good research about the right way to message to a vaccine hesitant population. It seems like it's decreasingly effective to talk about peer pressure or social norming, and more effective to reiterate the safety of the vaccine. And that message is most effective when it comes from Republican elected officials to Republican constituents. That people who are vaccine hesitant, who are supporters of Donald Trump, want to hear from Republican elected officials that the vaccine is safe. That's what the evidence is saying is the most effective messaging. And I'm not political about it. I just want people to get vaccines. So whatever works, we should be doing, which is why I'm so incredibly frustrated with my colleagues in Congress from the Republican Party who are unwilling to tell their constituents who would listen to them that this vaccine is safe and they need to get it. That is a moral responsibility. That is a patriotic responsibility that these Republicans have, and they're abdicating it.
Any conversations in the back rooms trying to sway Republican colleagues to carry a different message? And is the prevalence of the Delta variant starting to change people's minds?
After what we've seen over the last 18 months of this virus, after the willingness that we've seen from Trump and his enablers to politicize even the most basic science and public health, I have limited confidence, but I'm certainly going to continue to keep trying.
Okay, let's stay up on the Hill. I want to talk about infrastructure for a minute. Democrat leadership in the Senate wanted to start debate today on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. Republicans, however, are saying they don't want to start debate without further negotiations on the details. I mean, the details haven't really been hammered fully out yet. It kind of looks like this is turning into a standoff on how to proceed. But before today, it seemed like the bipartisan effort was moving. Are we in trouble here?
We're in the middle of negotiations. And as you well know, as I'm sure our listeners can appreciate, in politics, whenever you're in the middle of negotiations, it always kind of feels a little bit murky. I just want to pierce through the day in, day out politics, though, and just again express what we're actually trying to do. What we're trying to do is fix roads and bridges. We're trying to expand transit. We're trying to ensure clean water. And we're trying to expand high-speed internet access. And these four pillars are bipartisan everywhere except Washington, D.C. Democrat and Republican state and local elected officials in Massachusetts see and feel the need from Fall River to Brookline. This is tremendously popular legislation. We are going to get it done, but we got to stick the dismount, and we're currently still doing the twists and turns in the middle of the air.
So I think this is confusing for most people, Congressman, because we have the narrower bipartisan bill that's being hammered out on some what one might call more traditional infrastructure items. And then we have a $3.5 trillion spending package that Democrats have committed to putting through. It seems the main battle line is between putting both through or not getting the bipartisan, narrower roads and bridges kind of bill through. Is that linking the core of the problem? And is it sort of, you know, at all costs? Are you willing to give up a bipartisan bill that is bipartisan, if smaller, in order to get the bigger thing done?
At the end of the day, we're going to advance the Biden agenda, whether it's on strictly partisan lines or whether it's with bipartisan votes. We are going to pass something. We're going to ensure that the president and that congressional Democrats are able to keep our campaign promises to the American people, which was about rebuilding an economy that's working for everybody. So we're going to get it done. Let me just try to maybe speak to why the bipartisan effort is worth pursuing right now. And that is, it comes down to policy. With reconciliation, with the maneuver that you have to do if you only have Democratic votes, you can't do as much policy change as you want to do because of the rules of the House and the Senate reconciliation process. You can only do funding changes. You can't do policy changes. That does cut into what this infrastructure bill can accomplish, because we made significant policy changes in our infrastructure funding in the House version. We changed how we think about mobility away from car-centric highways to connecting people to jobs and services through all kinds of modalities, from trains to walking and cycling. And it would be disappointing to lose that opportunity to really change policy to make it more climate resilient and to make it more conducive to a more fair economy.
All right. So before we let you go, I do want to shift gears, and I want to ask you about H.R. 3, which aims to further regulate the price of prescription drugs. You're a co-sponsor of the bill, but you also co-authored a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi objecting to a clause in the bill. So that's kind of a dual position. Can you explain it?
As you said, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, and have 100% voting record with the Democratic caucus. So I am going and I'm working with the Speaker's office to ensure that Democrats pass drug pricing legislation. I also think that we can and should be lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients. That is a really critical feature of lowering prescription drug prices, is lowering it for Medicare and what the government pays, yes, but making sure we pass through those savings to what people actually pay at the countertop. And so I have been advocating for a hard cap on insulin drug prices per month and a hard cap on all out-of-pocket costs per month, so that our senior citizens and indeed all Americans are not put underwater by prescription drug costs.
So you have said that your objection is to HR3's clause capping prescription prices subject to federal negotiation at 120% of the average price in some other countries. And it seems your argument is about innovation and ensuring that, you know, there are new R&D investments. I know you're aware that the Huffington Post has argued that this is reflective of a position of the pharmaceutical industry and reported on you receiving both super PAC donations to a super PAC that supported you and donations to your campaign from pharma. What's your response there?
Well, I've been a supporter of Medicare negotiations since before I was even elected to Congress. So I'm a strong supporter of Medicare's ability to negotiate drug prices. We need to ensure that we are lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients, and that will eat into corporate profits. And the kind of blowback that you've seen against me, I think, is a reflection of what happens when you push back against putting profits over patients.
So what's the objection?
The objection is that we need to bring all parties to the table here. We need to bring the health insurers and the PBMs and make sure that they are actually lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients, as well as lowering list prices for the government.
And you're worried about innovation being suppressed if we shoot too far?
I think any drug pricing policy needs to account for out-of-pocket costs for patients. It needs to account for delivering cures for diseases like Alzheimer's and diabetes and cancer. And it needs to account for the important jobs that the life sciences sector creates, Massachusetts first and foremost. So it's a three-legged stool here. Number one is that people's monthly out-of-pocket costs are capped so that they can afford the drugs that they need for their treatments.
Okay, so I do want to come back to this, and I'm just going to push on this part one more time, because there were some large donations to the Super PAC, including one from Dr. Lori Glimcher, who is your mother, who sits on the board of directors of GlaxoSmithKline. It's not unusual to get pushback about concerns about campaign contributions and how they affect a legislator's choices on the floor. What are you doing to reassure constituents that you have a firewall between your donations and the positions that you're taking?
Well, I've got broad-based support across Massachusetts, across the host of professions, because people see that I am reflecting their values and advancing their priorities. My voting record is speaking for itself here. I think going to bat for patients out of pocket costs, going to bat for delivering cures is something very in line with what my voters want to see.
All right. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks.
It's always good to be with you.
Now, on to the pandemic, where Cape Cod is seeing an uptick in cases and state health officials are monitoring the spread. The Cape has seen a cluster of about 30 residents and staff at a Yarmouth nursing home test positive. And in Provincetown, a cluster of more than 130 cases, mostly among those already vaccinated. And that pushed the town to reissue an indoor mask advisory. Joining us to discuss that community's response is Alex Morse, town manager of Provincetown. And Alex, how do you view the problem there? What's behind the surge in cases?
So it's important to remember that Provincetown has a population of 3,000 residents year-round, and in the summer we ballooned to a population of upwards of 60,000 people a day. And so we're a decent-sized city in the summer, and when you have tens of thousands of people congregating in very densely populated spaces and venues, there are certainly a number of unvaccinated individuals that are traveling here. But I think if anything, when we think about this cluster, it's showing us that the vaccine is working, given that the majority of cases in the cluster are vaccinated individuals showing mild symptoms. And so I think it's also an example of having to sort of shift our thinking to a new normal of, unfortunately, having to live with the virus. You know, we want to continue tracking severity of symptoms among vaccinated and level of hospitalizations. And, you know, until we see, or if we see a steep increase in those two indicators, then I think we'd be more concerned, but we're doing the best we can to manage it. It's still very much possible to, you know, have a fun and safe time in Provincetown, but we want to make sure we get this advisory out and raise the public consciousness on COVID, that it's still very much with us.
So on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is everything's okay and 5 is holy cow, this is a crisis, what's your number right now, Alex?
I would say we're at a 2. You know, unfortunately, as a nation, we still have less than 50% of our population fully vaccinated. And there are some things that need to happen to increase vaccination and vaccine hesitant communities. We're getting the word out that testing is the most important thing that people can do right now to detect and test early. Get vaccinated. Again, the numbers are showing that vast majority are vaccinated with mild symptoms, and we need to get those numbers up. So we thank the State Department of Public Health for deploying mobile testing and mobile vaccination here. We've had over 3,000 people get tested in the last week and a half. We've issued over 20 vaccinations in the last few days. And so we are seeing an uptick in people getting tested and people getting vaccinated here.
So over the next 2 weeks, if everything were going perfectly, what would be your success metrics for these next couple weeks?
Well, I think, you know, the incubation period for COVID is about 2 weeks, right? So we know that the first 2 weeks of July are among the two busiest weeks in Provincetown. And so we're hopeful that between this week and next week, we have family week, that there's a number of behavioral changes that happen in town as a result of the advisory, but also happen naturally. We do want to see more folks masking indoors, particularly in places where social distancing is impossible, very densely populated places, think nightclubs or bars, dance venues where, you know, thousands of people go out at night and are very close to each other. And so the advisory does touch on that and other forms of contact as well, in which COVID could be spread through respiratory droplets. So we do want to see a change in behavior. We do want to see increased testing, increased vaccination. You know, our mobile testing van right now is testing about 275 to 300 people a day. We're getting daily reports as to what percentage of those folks are testing positive. And so we're able to track on a daily basis. Is it going up? Is it going down? Is it staying the same? And so it's too soon for us to come to conclusions right now, but we're hopeful in a few days or in at least a week, we're starting to see it stabilize.
And do you know what percentage of your positive tests are the Delta variant? Are you able to track Delta in this midst?
So we're working closely with the State Department of Public Health on this, and they've said they will have further information on that exact point by tomorrow. And so they are doing their due diligence to provide that evidence. I mean, an educated guess would tell us that it is the Delta variant, but we want to be sure of the science and research behind that before we declare that publicly. But it would be very surprising if it was not the Delta variant, given the level of how contagious it is.
So earlier in this week, here on Radio Boston, we spoke with Rob Anderson, who's owner of the canteen in Provincetown. He told us that he's looking for clear, consistent guidance, strong leadership from officials about what to do. So I want to ask you, has the messaging been clear from the state, the feds, in regards to what to do about breakthrough cases? And do you have what you need to do the clear, consistent things in Provincetown for your community?
Yes, we have been very clear. And so Provincetown really led the way over the last year in keeping public health as the main driver of decision making. Everything happening in Provincetown over the last several weeks, has been in accordance with state guidelines, regulatory guidelines, and CDC guidance. And so we thought it was important for the Board of Health and the Select Board and leaders in town to declare an advisory, given the uptick in data. One of our options, obviously, was to do nothing and let this pass, but we chose to do an advisory. We worked hand in hand with Barnstable County Health Department and the State Department of Public Health with the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control. And so we are all united and on the same page. We're hopeful that, again, with this advisory and some changes in behavior, we'll start to see some stability and the numbers start to come down as we exit, again, two of the busiest weeks that we've had.
All right. Alex Morse is the town manager in Provincetown. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Across the country, support for free public transit is gaining momentum. Several cities in Massachusetts have already scrapped fares for at least some buses. And all the major candidates in Boston's mayoral race have expressed some support for the idea. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman explains why the free fare concept is catching on.
The 37 bus pulls into the Lawrence Transportation Depot, and driver Francisco opens the door and rests his hand over the fare box as passengers board.
They're going to pay. I say, no, this bus is free. They say, all right, thank you. People like it.
Carol Aquino of Lawrence used to buy monthly passes. She appreciates the free bus rides.
Saves me money that I can do in other things. You know, with everything going on, it was a great help. Now that I have to come out of my pocket to pay for it.
The 37 is one of three bus routes in Lawrence that has been free for nearly 2 years. Ridership has jumped almost 25%, and the city's mayor recently announced plans to extend the program for another 2 years. And other Massachusetts cities are experimenting with free mass transit as well. The Worcester Regional Transit Authority has been using federal pandemic relief money to offer fare-free bus service for more than a year. Brockton has made rides free on summer weekends. And Boston Acting Mayor Kim Janey wants to waive fares on a popular bus route through the heart of the city.
I am delivering a free bus now as mayor, connecting a major economic corridor from Mattapan Square to Grove Hall to Nubian Square.
So the 28 can go to Ruggles Station if you stand over in this line.
An MBTA officer at Nubian Square gives directions to the 28 bus. That's the one Boston wants to make free. But dropping the fare has proved complicated. The city and T have spent months trying to work out the details. And passengers along the route have questions too.
The bus's route is going to become what? Free?
Tony Johnson waits for a friend at the 28 bus stop.
How would they stay in business? Why would it be free?
I would like to know how come you only want to do the 28 bus.
This is Tony Johnson's brother, Bobby.
Why not somewhere more convenient like downtown? Yeah, I feel like the Silver Line would be more convenient for people if it was free, not the 28.
Some politicians also want to go beyond the 28 and explore ways to make the entire MBTA bus system free, something that would cost about $60 million a year, or even eliminate fares on subways and commuter trains, which would cost much more. The issue has become a hot topic in the Boston mayoral race. All of the major candidates support some form of free transit.
When I first called to make the T free 3 years ago, people told me the idea was impossible.
City Councilor Michelle Wu has made free public transit a centerpiece of her campaign.
And you can take it from me. Public transportation should be free.
And outside of Boston, a growing number of state and national leaders say there are many benefits to ending fares.
More than many other districts in the state, mass transit is important in my district.
State Senator Will Brownsberger sits in a bus shelter along the 73 route in Cushing Square, Belmont. Brownsberger, one of the most influential Democrats on Beacon Hill, argues getting rid of bus fares would speed up service.
People don't have to delay to get on and off, use any door anytime. That's good for everybody. That's good for the operation of buses, especially at rush hour.
Brownsberger says buses would spend less time idling at stops, so there'd be less exhaust pollution, cleaner air. Powerful arguments on Beacon Hill, where there's a proposal that would require the T and regional transit authorities to try fare-free pilot projects statewide. And there are efforts nationwide, one led by Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley and U.S. Senator Ed Markey, would provide $5 billion in grants to help transit systems eliminate fees. Pressley says it's about equity.
It's a matter of justice, economic, environmental, and also racial justice. I really do see transit at the center of all of these issues. And our bill would really allow everyone in community to move freely, hence the Freedom to Move Act.
Many cities across the country have used pandemic funding to help temporarily drop fares, but some have begun charging again, citing the cost. In Boston, the MBTA says it's focused mainly on service upgrades rather than dropping fares. David Bragdon, executive director of Transit Center in New York City, agrees.
Every other industrialized country in the world has better transit than the United States does. And the way they have achieved that is the tried and true fundamental way of providing really abundant, good transit.
Bragdon argues it's better to offer discounts to low-income riders than do away with fares altogether. Roughly one-third of the MBTA's annual revenue comes from passengers, and the T says that money would be tough to replace. But advocates point out that just 10% of the fare revenue comes from bus riders.
I'm not crazy when I say it might just be easier to make the buses free.
Stacey Thompson is executive director of Livable Streets Alliance. She says regional transit authorities waste as much as 70% of the fares they collect on buses just collecting fares. Once you factor in all the costs from buying and maintaining ticket machines and paying workers to sort through the cash. The MBTA plans to roll out a new automated fare collection system over the next 3 years, but Thompson says it'll cost close to $1 billion.
So they're not spending that money on increasing service. They're just spending the money they're collecting largely from low-income people to collect those dollars and cents over and over again. What is the point of that?
Thompson says free buses have been proven to work. The Silver Line bus connecting Boston's Logan Airport to South Station has been free for people leaving the airport since 2012, helping to reduce traffic. And some universities have offered free shuttles for decades. Now Thompson argues it's time to make the entire bus system in Greater Boston free as well.
If public transit is a public good, then we should treat it that way, and we should fund it like we fund schools and libraries. What does the service cost? Let's make sure we have the resources to achieve that.
So while some transit systems across the country want to maintain fares, others are considering making their service free and finding ways to make up the lost revenue. How Boston and the MBTA might do it remains to be seen.
That from WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. To see a roundup of the major Boston mayoral candidates' positions on free mass transit, you can visit WBUR.org. We are asking, should the T be free? More communities are asking that question and experimenting with answers. Before the break, we heard a report from WBUR's Bruce Gellerman on the growing movement to make public transit free in the Commonwealth. But now we want to hear from you. What do you think? Should it be free? Or maybe just, should buses be free? Or maybe improving service levels is more important than making it free. If some or all of the T were free, would you be willing to pay for it through fees or higher taxes? And on the other side, if free transit would be a game changer for you, tell us why and how. Bring it all on. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. We have a couple of great guests to guide us along the way. We're joined by Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of Livable Streets Alliance, and Lawrence Acting Mayor Kendris Vasquez, who recently announced an extension of that city's free bus pilot program. Stacey, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Mayor Vasquez, welcome to you too.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about this very important subject today.
So Stacey, I'm going to start with you. You've been working in this space for a while. Why do you think the call to free the T up, to make it free, is so resonant right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing two things happen. One, because of the leadership of folks like Mayor Vasquez, we've had a couple of fare-free pilots in Massachusetts, and they've been successful in getting folks back on transit, right? Like, we know that it works. And so when you see something as effective, you want more of that. And we desperately need more people on transit. But separately, you know, what I often say, this shocks people. Bus fares on the MBTA have gone up by 300% in the last few decades, and that has not produced better service. So I think it's time to really ask hard questions about why we're collecting these fares in the first place.
So Mayor Vasquez, I've been eager to speak with you because you're actually running free buses in your city on three routes. What's been the overall takeaway?
Just so you know, this program started back in 2019 when I was actually the city council president, and we made the MVRTA free for people in the city of Lawrence in three particular routes. This program has been a win-win for our community. It encourages, you know, bus ridership, which has increased in the city of Lawrence. In a community like ours, this is extremely important. You know, we're talking about environmental justice. We are talking about, you know, less people using their cars, which actually occupy a lot more space and releases harmful pollutants to the, you know, to that, that affect people's health. So essentially, we are addressing multiple concerns at the city level, not just the transportation as it is. We're ensuring that people are able to get to work, ensure that, you know, our families are able to bring their kids to, you know, doctor's appointments and to school.
So let's talk about the other side of that for a second, because I understand the city's paying the Merrimack Valley Regional Transit Authority $450,000 to make up for the 4 years of lost revenue. How do you pay for that? Where's that money coming from?
So this is money that is coming directly from our free cash or our surplus account. And if we were to look at the whole budget of the city of Lawrence, it accounts for 0.065% of the budget. And I think that this is a very significant investment for our community members to ensure that they continue to have services that are necessary. So we are prioritizing our community members in this project.
So let's turn to the phones, and then Stacey, I'm going to come back to you, 1-800-423-8255. To talk about free public transit, we've got Pamela on the line in Concord. Pamela, go ahead.
Hi. I think that you said it very well at the very beginning. Transportation is a public good. I can easily afford to pay for it, but I believe it should be free for everyone. We shouldn't make it harder to be poor in our towns. And we also shouldn't make it a stigma that only the poor people ride free. That's ridiculous.
Pamela, thank you for that call. I appreciate it. I'm also going to pick up Mike here in Pembroke. Mike, go ahead.
Hi. I think free public transit is a great idea, but I don't see how we pay for this. And if I live on the South Shore, so I'm fortunate I can take advantage, but where I work, it doesn't work for me, so I have to drive anyways. But for the rest of the residents, you know, Central and Western Mass, where the cost, you know, in the Boston area for public transit is going to far outweigh, you know, their local regional cost, I don't see how that can be paid for, you know, fairly, equitably, across the taxpayers of the state.
Thanks for that call, Mike. So, Stacey of Livable Streets, I'm going to turn back to you here. You've made some statements about cost and what the real costs would be. We heard you with Bruce Gellerman before the break. Talk a little bit about this.
Sure. And you know what? It's that we hear this a lot, but I would say two things. One, I think we should think about the regional transit authorities and the MBTA a little differently. We could make all of our regional transit authorities free for roughly $25 million. And that's a very small amount of the statewide budget annually. And so, you know, Lawrence wouldn't have to pay in. They could invest that money in other resources if the state legislature took that step. On the MBTA side, this is exactly why we want to take a measured approach and start with buses, because we don't actually collect that much money on buses, and we could get a real savings in terms of access, in terms of timing. And that is, you know, we'd like to start there and then work with the legislature on many proposals that are already out there to backfill the money that would be needed to make transit free. So it's a multi-step approach, but it is totally achievable based on the resources that are available and the number of legislative proposals that exist to backfill those funds.
So I'm going to bring a T voice actually in a couple of minutes. But before we do, Stacey, if one makes buses free, A, what about people who start on a bus but move to another form of transportation? And B, what about concerns that bus service is suboptimal or not as frequent or as fast or as available as it needs to be? And sort of starving the beast at a time when maybe better transit is actually the solution?
Sure. So a couple of things. We are very supportive of low-income fares for the MBTA because a lot of people do transfer to rail lines. I would also note that the legislature supported it and the governor himself vetoed low-income fares during the height of the pandemic. So, you know, we need leadership from the administration to actually make our fares equitable. And again, these aren't mutually exclusive topics. We do need better service. You know, Livable Streets has been asking the T to purchase 200 additional buses, run more service, do more work. The money we're collecting on buses right now isn't paying for that bus service. I think we need to think about where the funds are coming from, what they're paying for, and then focus on where the need is and go from there.
Did you have this kind of pushback, Mayor Vasquez, in your community as you started the program? And have there been, what about concerns by people who don't take the buses that their taxpayer dollars or other city funds are subsidizing?
In the community of Lawrence, when we started this program back in 2019, people understood that this was for the public good. And this is a conversation that, community members have had, and they're actually demanding that we continue to, support services like this for the general public. You know, they understand that, it has an impact in what we call environmental justice. It has an impact in ensuring that our business community continue to thrive because as a result of that, individuals are able to travel within our business district and not be concerned about how to get to from one place to the other. So it's about expansion at this point, and that's a conversation that my administration continue to have. Talking about, it's just like when we talk about improving our schools or our health system, we need to talk about improving our mobility because it is no longer an afterthought. This is not a luxury for, some community members. So the community in general has been very, very, positive in regards to this service.
To that, let's pick up some calls. 1-800-423-8255. Arlene is calling from Lawrence. Arlene, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I'm very, very happy with the public transit in my town, which is Lawrence. And thank you, Mayor Vasquez, for that. I truly appreciate it. And I know a lot of people in my community that are served with that and are able to move around as a result, otherwise would have been stranded because could not, whether afford it, or even people that can afford it sometimes don't want to drive their vehicle for lack of parking or what have you. But it is an excellent, excellent idea, at least for my community.
Thanks for the call, Arlene. I also want to pick up Carl in Orange. Carl, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead, Carl.
I'm trying to take you off speaker. Sorry.
So, Carl, we'll come back to you.
Go ahead. I got you off speaker. So, I live out in Orange, Mass, which is in Western Mass, and we're nowhere near any commuter rails or any T infrastructure that can take you into the city. And most people here don't come and go from the city and all my surrounding towns. And we don't work there where the pay scales tend to be higher. Even though pay scales out here are substantially lower. And I wouldn't think that it's right for so much of the state that doesn't have access or immediate access to these public transit lines to have to pay a tax or pay into that system. I do agree, though, if I lived in that area, that we probably should, and because we would use it, and it would benefit the city and those areas. So maybe they could set it up that the areas that the commuter rails and T lines reach get that tax. But to charge Western Mass for it, and there's an awful lot of population out here. I mean, it's more sparsely populated, but
yep,
there's a lot of people and a lot of taxpayers to the state that we never use it. We don't benefit from it, and we don't earn the income to be able to afford more taxes on top of taxes. I mean, the cost of living is getting to be insane as is.
Thanks for that call, Carl. I think that's an important perspective to bring into this mix, too. And I'm going to bring another one in now. So Mayor Vasquez and Stacey, sit tight. I'm going to bring in another voice here. Brian Kane is the executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So I'm going to put it straight to you. Do you think the T or buses on the T should be free?
It would be great if they could be, but the question is, how do we afford it? You know, the T's budget right now is only balanced because of $665 million in one-time federal funds. And because of hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funds for the next 2 years, they're okay. But starting in 2024, in June, in July of that year, they're looking at a massive deficit of $300 to $450 million. And to put that in perspective, the service cuts that we saw in Forging Ahead last winter were only trying to generate around $135 million. So the cuts that would be necessary if the T is forced to fund this by itself, you know, starting in 2024, would just be draconian and dramatic. And if we want to grow ridership, which I think is something we all agree we want to do, I just don't think this is the right approach right now.
And the idea that there's actually quite a bit of expense spent collecting fares that doesn't need to be if those fares are free, and that you know, money could be reinvested elsewhere?
Well, my good friend Stacey Thompson and I disagree on this topic. The money that the T is spending for its automated fare collection system, fare transformation, is capital money. And that's money that the T is borrowing to invest in its system, and it will pay back dividends over the next 30 years as it's paid for. It's not like if they stopped doing the fare transformation program right now, they could turn around and use that money to fund free fares. It just doesn't work that way. It's capital money versus operating.
So, Brian, you talked about, you know, the short-term, if you want to call it that, infusion of funds from the various COVID bills. We know that at the time that money came forward, the congressional delegation pushed hard on the T, that was to provide relief now, not to stave off future deficits. So why not at least experiment with free T to see if there could be cost benefits or benefits to low-income people that might make it worth it?
Well, the T-Zone analysis on this is that the cost would be in the realm of $60 million, mostly from something called induced demand. As buses are made free, there would be more demand for people to use them, which means the T would have to put more buses on the lines. Now, keep in mind, they don't have sufficient storage space to actually add more buses. We all wish they did, but they don't have anywhere to store them or put them or maintain them, let alone the money to pay the people that would have to do that. So in order to meet the demand, the T was actually going to have to degrade service in order to meet the demand for this free service. And so to me, it just doesn't make sense.
All right. I'm going to bring Stacey in here for just a second. Stacey Thompson, let me give you just a chance to react to what we've just heard from Brian Kane.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is maybe our favorite issue to debate. I'm so happy you brought my friend Brian on. And I would agree with him that we need to invest in the MBTA. I would also note that when we had, after another fare increase pre-pandemic, the MBTA was falling off of the same financial cliff that Brian was describing earlier. Our bus fares are not saving the T. And they, in fact, are just a small portion of the overall budget. So if we're specifically talking about making buses free, this is where I would disagree and say, you're right. The federal funds that our delegation fought for are meant to be used right now. Ridership is down. So that small portion of funding that comes from bus fares is even smaller right now. I might argue minuscule. Now is the time to use the federal funds that we're already using to backfill fares to make buses free and test our assumptions. Because what Brian described were assumptions that we disagree with. But because the T isn't moving forward with the pilot, we can't test those assumptions. You know, okay. I keep saying I look forward to the T proving me wrong.
All right. So, Brian, I'm going to give you one last word here before we say goodbye to you.
Oh, thanks, Tiziana. And like Stacey said, we like to debate this topic. We often do. And it's actually, you know, great that you know, folks like herself and Mayor Vasquez are working on this and trying to improve transit in general. And that's what it's all about. The MBTA needs additional funds. It needs more funds from either something like the Freedom of Movement Act that was discussed in Bruce Gellerman's piece, or from the state legislature. The T is subsidized to the tune of over $1 billion a year right now across the Commonwealth. Unfortunately, that is not enough. It's certainly not enough for its massive backlog of capital needs. And unfortunately, it just needs additional money to get through these lean years when ridership is down, and taking fare revenue off the table just isn't going to do that. And I'm just afraid we're going to just be back in a service cut situation again if we go down this road.
All right. Brian Kane is the executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mayor Vasquez, I want to ask you this concern that when you stop taking in revenues, you wind up reducing service. I mean, it seems pretty logical. If you don't have money coming in, you can't maintain and upkeep. How has that played out for you?
So that actually has not happened with us, because we are providing the funding via our surplus account to the NVRTA. So essentially, the city of Lawrence has decided to pay the fare to the for any rider. So the program itself is being paid out of free cash, our free cash account. And we can clearly show that the ridership has increased here in the city of Lawrence. We are ensuring that we continue to expand on the service. So the service has not declined in our city by making it, a free, accessible, transportation program. On the contrary, I think that the program itself has demonstrated that there's a greater need, and we need to continue to address it as we move forward in my administration.
I'd like to pick up one more call here. We've got Glenn on the line in Maynard. Glenn, go ahead.
Hi. I hear all this discussion without hearing anything about our impact on the environment, on the climate change, and how the T is an element that can help save people from using their automobiles, because out here it's a commuter rail situation for us in Maynard. And taking the train would be, if there was a way to accentuate use of the train, it would be helpful to the environment.
Thank you. And so just lightning round to our two guests first. Mayor Vasquez, did it increase ridership?
It did. It has increased ridership in the city of Lawrence, over 25%, which means that, we're addressing environmental justice here in the community, and we're ensuring that people have access to their jobs and, doctor's appointments and the day-to-day lives.
And Stacey, what does the research tell us about its impact on car usage and congestion?
People are more likely to get on a bus or a train when that transit is free, and that will have a positive net impact on people who are driving on our roads every day.
All right. So I think then the last question is, the two of you are making a case that seems very clear, but we don't do this. There aren't tons and tons of communities that are doing free public transit. It must be quite hard. How do you address the obstacles? Now, let me backtrack. I'm not coming down on one side of this or the other, but my last question is, if it were this good, why are not more places doing it? Stacey.
I think because we are not treating public transit like a public good. Every time I bring this up, folks say, well, but you should pay to use transit. And I say, well, schools, public health, public libraries demonstrate that when you shift your mindset, which is what we need, a shift in mindset, that public transit is a public good with environmental benefits, public health benefits, then it becomes easier to make the financial case for public transit. So I think that's key. And I think separately, places are doing this. LA Metro, which is a massive transit agency, is moving forward with a fare-free pilot. I would like Boston to speed up and beat them.
All right. I'm actually going to have to end it there. That's Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of the Livable Streets Alliance. And we've also had Lawrence Mayor Kendris Vasquez, where a free bus system has been in place in a pilot form for 4 years. Thanks to the both of you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry, since 2019, I said 4 years, I got all excited there. Sorry about that. Thanks again to both of you. All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beland. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.